Wanted. Wanted for armed robbery. This is the program that brings you, for the first time on the air, a nationwide manhunt in action. The actual facts to date of a man wanted. From the record, hear the on-the-spot reports of the people involved. Nothing is withheld, no one is protected. Here are the dramatic eyewitness accounts of a man wanted. Wanted for armed robbery.
And now, Alan Hind, America's foremost recorder of the criminal scene.
Good evening. Tonight and every week at this same time, you and I are going on a manhunt. We're going to trace the career of a wanted man through the actual eyewitnesses involved, through innocent bystanders, through the friends and relatives of victims, and through the police officers who have worked and who are now working on the case. The voices you will hear are those of actual people involved, speaking to you from actual locales involved. They are putting themselves on the spot to give you first-hand information about a man who is wanted. A few weeks ago, one of the most daring daylight robberies in the annals of modern crime crashed into the headlines. The criminals were no strangers to the police. Their leader is wanted and has been wanted, off and on, for 20 years. Today, he is the hottest fugitive in this country. And believe me, you may be his next victim. So listen. Here are the facts.
The date, October 29th, 1930. The location, M. Rosenthal & Sons, a jewelry shop on Broadway in the Capitol Theater Building, the heart of New York City.
The voices you hear next are those of the actual people who, through no fault of their own, are involved in the case of FBI number 241884. First, a 68-year-old man.
I was a porter for M. Rosenthal & Sons. One morning, a postal messenger came to the door with a telegram for my firm. I went to the door, received the telegram. He handed me a paper saying, "Sign here, please." I took the paper, signed it, handed back to him. The same time, he pushed a gun in my stomach and says, "Back, back." I backed back. He came in and he said, "Stand still. My partner will be in just a moment." A few seconds later, his partner came in, a smartly dressed businessman with a fall overcoat, a gray hat, gray kid gloves, and a black bag. Then they put me in behind the showcase. He took out a box of picture wire, placed it around my left leg, and started to play it out. In the meantime, the messenger said, "Just do what you're told, and you'll not be hurt. We know what we came in here for, and we're going to get it." They played the wire so I could walk across the floor, allowing me room enough to come from there to the door, with the businessman holding the other end of the wire. They asked me what time the employees came in, and I said around 9 o'clock. The first employee to show in was Mr. Charles F. Hayes.
My name is Charles Hayes. On the morning I arrived at the store, I was greeted by the porter. And suddenly a gun was stuck in my back, and I was asked to sit down. And my hands were tied with a wire, awaiting the arrival of Mr. Fox, who had the combination of the safe.
I'm Julius Fox, a salesman at Rosenthal's. When I arrived, I was greeted by a postal telegraph messenger. He told me this was a stick-up. He says, "Just be quiet, and we won't harm you." He then told me to go to the safe to open it. I went to the safe, but being that I very seldom use the combination, I told the porter I don't remember it. So they then tied me up, and they told the porter to call Mr. Rosenthal at home to get the combination.
My name is Joe Rosenthal. I was awakened early one morning by the phone ringing, and when I answered it, my porter was on the phone asking me for the combination of the safe. I was so disgusted at the idea of their having to call me for that I gave it to him twice. I then went in to have my breakfast, and something dawned on me rather strangely, and I called back on the phone. And when I did, the police were already there, and my salesman informed me that we were robbed of $130,000.
This is Captain McVeigh, the New York City Police Department Main Office Squad. I received a call of a robbery in M. Rosenthal & Sons jewelry store. Went down to investigate and found out it was a well-planned job. Number one, there was gloves worn because there was no fingerprints. Two, they had known all about the burglar alarm system in the store, which they avoided. Three, of the two safes was in there, they know which one to go to. But we had a good description of both men.
The job was to find two unidentified men in a city of 7 million. Police reasoned these men were experienced operators, so they searched the files looking for jobs done in a similar pattern. They came up with eight. Eight jobs, one pattern, no solution. That was lead number one, and it pointed nowhere. The second lead came from the postal telegraph uniform worn by one of the crooks.
My name is Anthony Lanzell. I'm with the Eves Costume Company. We furnish costumes for all occasions, masquerade and so on. A man came in one day and asked for a messenger boy's uniform. So I found a postal messenger's uniform and I packed it up for him. And he paid me $10, the rental of the uniform, and $15 deposit. He handed me a card marked J.R. Hancock, the Waverly School of Drama, 507 Fifth Avenue.
Mr. J.R. Hancock at 507 Fifth Avenue was a mailing address.
Dead end? No. Mr. J.R. Hancock had appeared at that office just once when he rented it, and he had been in the company of an unforgettable red-haired young lady. Note, New York is full of blondes and brunettes, but redheads are scarce. Armed with descriptions of two men and a redhead, detectives spread out, covering greater New York. Then, a real break.
I don't know if this will help you, mister, but two postal telegraph messengers were stopped by a man who wanted to borrow their uniforms. He sounds like the man you're looking for. Interesting thing, both of the boys were stopped on West End Avenue. Matter of fact, the 500 block.
The 500 block of West End Avenue was staked out. Object, one redhead. Days of legwork, thousands of questions, and a few answers.
Yeah, I seen a redhead who looks like her somewhere around here.
Why, the girl you mean lives three houses down from here.
Well, you'll find her tonight at Child's Restaurant over on 73rd Street.
My name is John Vialli. I was relief manager at Child's Restaurant at 73rd Street in Broadway. That evening, about 7 p.m., a pretty red-headed girl came in with a dark-haired young man who seemed to be a little nervous. About 10 minutes later, two detectives came out from the service entrance and tapped him on his shoulder. I said, come along with me, and that's all I know.
That arrested man was Willie Sutton. William Sutton, a name familiar to the police. They looked up his record.
Arrested five times. The first two charges were dismissed due to youth as defendant. Third arrest, homicide, Sutton was acquitted. The fourth charge, burglary, sentenced 5 to 10 years, paroled after serving four. On his most recent arrest, he was picked up for possession of burglary tools. For that, he spent one day in the city jail.
Now William Sutton was booked for the Rosenthal robbery and placed in the lineup. The witnesses were called in and...
Sure, that's the fella in the postal uniform.
Yep, that's the one that held the gun.
Absolutely, he's the man.
Identification confirmed. In short order, police picked up Sutton's accomplice in Buffalo and he confessed. They got the book. 30 years in Sing Sing. Now Sutton was safely behind bars. But he formed a prison partnership with a hulking burglar named John Egan. On December 12, 1932, prison officials announced...
Convicts William Sutton and John Egan are wanted by this institution for jailbreak.
William Sutton and John Egan had crashed out of the escape-proof wing of Sing Sing. Now Sutton had priority attention of police departments throughout the nation. Police began developing information. Soon they got a line on Egan, and they found him.
Egan was murdered. Somebody had filled him full of lead.
Sutton was suspected, but with Egan's death, Sutton's trail came to an end. Then Sutton made his whereabouts known.
New York City. On the morning of July 9, 1933, the 110th Street branch of a corn exchange bank was robbed of $23,835. One of the holdup men was disguised as a captain of police. January 15th, 1934, the West Philadelphia branch of the Corn Exchange Bank was robbed of $21,000. The bandits timed the job to avoid all burglar alarms.
Two bank heists, and in both, the unmistakable Sutton trademark was evident. Out of the New York and Philly jobs, police had one clue, a piece of paper found on the floor of the Corn Exchange Bank.
This is Captain John J. Hanlon, Philadelphia Police Department. In making the investigation, we found a small portion of an automobile registration card. It was not much to go by other than it contained several words of handwriting. The card was then sent to the Automobile Registration Bureau, where the writing was compared with 28,000 cards in the files of the Automobile Bureau. And as a result of the check made, we learned that the card belonged to Ed Wilson, from which we learned his automobile license number.
Ed Wilson. That name had a familiar ring to New York police. They checked. Wilson, small-time hoodlum, robber, gunpunk. Where did he fit in? Was he one of the two men with Sutton on the New York and Philly jobs? Police got a line on Wilson, and according to our reconstruction of the facts.
Ed Wilson. Sure, he's around town. She won't find him with his wife and family. He's laying low, hiding out in Yonkers. I heard tell of the... driving into New York on Sunday night with that girl.
Sure, Wilson and Nina were planning on a big time. They were headed for Broadway. But on 262nd Street, a squad car spotted his license plate and tailed him into town. The police tried to force Wilson to the curb. The dope got panicky and tried to knock off five cops.
At Broadway and 240th Street, New York City, detectives Frank Phillips and Daniel Shee in self-defense fired, wounding one Ed Wilson in both eyes. No further resistance was offered.
Wilson thought he was dying and was willing to talk. Taken in for questioning, he admitted his part in the New York and Philly jobs. He implicated Sutton and one Joseph Perlongo. He didn't know where Sutton was, but he did give police Perlongo's Brooklyn address.
My name is Detective James E. Sheehy. I was attached to the West 47th Street Station House in New York City. The boys raided the Perlongo apartment. Perlongo was brought in. He wouldn't talk, but as a result of the search of his apartment, a letter was found, which letter was received from a Richard Courtney. This handwriting, after analysis, proved to be the handwriting of William Sutton. In the upper right-hand corner of this letter was found an address, 47th and Chester Avenues in Philadelphia. Our department notified the Philadelphia police.
Detective John J. Kelly, Field Number 1667, Detective Headquarters, Philadelphia. Upon our arrival at the apartment house at 47th and Chester Avenue, it was found that Mr. and Mrs. Richard Courtney, who in reality were Mr. and Mrs. Willie Sutton, were absent. Our commanding officer detailed a squad of detectives, including myself, to continue the surveillance from the adjoining apartment. At 5 o'clock that afternoon, the Suttons were observed to return. That was the signal for our descent upon their apartment. It was well that we had a concentrated force of men. Upon bursting into the apartment, it was found to be a veritable arsenal of weapons. Three pistols, a submachine gun, a sawed-off shotgun, and a vast quantity of ammunition was found. In addition, concealed in Sutton's trunk was found the uniform of a captain of New York City Police, and in addition, the uniform of the United States mailman. For recreational purposes, no doubt, there was also found, among Willie's effects, a large, expensive set of golf clubs.
Willie, the actor, confessed to the Philadelphia bank job because he felt Pennsylvania would be easier on him than New York. He went to court looking for a light sentence. According to the court record, Judge Harry S. McDevitt ruled,
I will see that you are sentenced to spend the rest of your life in prison where you belong. I've been criticized by spineless men and weak-minded women for imposing the maximum sentence on such men as you. My answer to that criticism is that I will give you every day the law allows.
Thank you. full sentence, 25 to 50 years of solitary confinement at Eastern State Penitentiary.
This is Warden Burke to the Eastern Penitentiary in Philadelphia. I think you can hear the prison band playing now. We have here at this institution a population of 1,100. I spent a day at Alcatraz prison. At that time, they had a population of 268. Out of the population of the Eastern State Penitentiary, we have at least 400 just as dangerous and as vicious as they have at Alcatraz. And amongst them at one time was Willie Sutton, who has since left us. Now, Willie Sutton, while an inmate at the prison, never gave us any trouble. But at the same time, we knew Willie Sutton's mind, at least we knew that Willie Sutton's mind was working and working to one end, and that was to leave us, other than the right way. And I mean by the right way is going out the gate.
My name is Officer John Craig. I'm in charge of the 7th Gallery, where William Sutton formerly locked. In this cell, the floor was formerly made covered with wood. And one morning while making the inspection, I noticed the floorboard had been loose. When discovering this, I opened it and underneath found a plaster Paris head made up identically like Willie Sutton. The head was covered with hair, which was no doubt gathered from the various barber shops, and the head was painted and was a very good likeness of William Sutton. I also found a arm under there, 3 crude bombs, a bunch of keys, and a revolver carved from a piece of wood. Of course, we took sent out for Willie Sutton and placed him under arrest, and of course, this broke up the attempted escape. But later on, another attempt was made by him, which was discovered by Officer Brown.
This is Officer Brown, guard Eastern State Penitentiary. One morning, I missed 11 men from my section. I went to the back of the block, and there in the cell, I saw a form in bed, which I thought was phony. Entered the cell, I ripped the covers from the bed. There was a phony body and a head made of plaster. And knowing the work of Willie Sutton, I knew this was a break. Looking around the cell, I saw a coat hanging on the wall. It looked out of place. This coat I ripped from the wall and found a large hole leading to a tunnel. I went down in the tunnel and I found it was a narrow, slimy mud pit. These men had to crawl on their hands and knees on their backs and anyway to wiggle out of that hole, which was 97 feet long. At the end of the tunnel, underneath the wall, was a pit of water, 8 feet across with a high-tension line with electric lights dangling in the water. There was 3 inches of airspace separating the water and the wall. These men had to crawl and slide through this water to get their freedom on the other side of that wall. I then made my report to Major Tees.
Major Tees, Deputy Warden of the Eastern State Penitentiary. I received a report that there had been an escape made. I immediately notified the Philadelphia police and the state police. Within 25 minutes, we had Willie Sutton captured. Within a week, we had the entire group back into the prison. We found that Willie Sutton was too familiar with the Eastern State Penitentiary. We then had him transferred to the Philadelphia County Prison at Holmesburg.
Escape-proof Holmesburg. Slick Willie had been transferred because here was one penitentiary where he would be helpless. Holmesburg hadn't had an escape in 50 years. 2 years later, on the 10th of February, Sutton and 4 others crashed out. Again, Sutton was wanted. This time, police flooded the country with wanted bulletins. Lead after lead developed, but no payoff. Then on March 9th, 1950, in Sunnyside, Long Island, at 8:30 a.m., the New York police got their first definite lead on William Sutton.
My name is James Weston, a vault custodian for the Manufacturers Trust Company at 4711 Queens Boulevard. The morning of March the 9th, I came to work at 8:30. As I opened the door, I was rushed from the back. I thought it was somebody kidding, and I wrestled with him. He then stuck a gun in my ribs, ordered me to get inside, saying, "We're desperate." I then realized it was serious. I got inside. He then went back, admitted the other two, locked the door. They then chained me with a chain around my ankle to the grill of the radiator inside the door. ordered me to admit all employees as they came to the door, saying it'd be too bad if anybody turned away, not to use any signs. I did this for an hour and a quarter till all employees were admitted.
I worked at Sunnyside. I thought it was rather unusual when the floor custodian was at the door. As a rule, he's never at the door. I always have to ring the bell, and then I stay in there and say, what's the idea of making me wait? See, that's my usual routine with him, you know. I thought it was rather peculiar this morning. So as he opened the door, you know, that was his routine, to open the door. He had no alternative. He had to open it. And no sooner I entered the vestibule, see, we have a vestibule going into the bank, I was grabbed by my arm like this, see. And what I had thought is probably it was the auditor. See, we had the auditor there. There were a couple of months before, and they were coming in, and something new has been added, you know. So I got inside, and I saw all these chairs lined up facing towards the wall of the cages. So I thought, yeah, it was rather funny. Not thinking any more of it, you know. I was sat down in the chair, and I sat there. So I was wondering why everybody was shaking, you know. It didn't enter my mind that what was transpiring during this here, you know, during my coming in. So I sat there and watched everybody, and I saw them shake their hands shaking, you know, of the other girls, not the boys, but the girls. So as I had turned my head this way, I was sitting this way, and I turned my head, and the fellow that was in back of us doing all the directing, I noticed his hand was like this, and he had a revolver in it. So immediately when I saw that, it entered my mind what was transpiring. And the assistant manager and teller number one had already opened the vault.
My name is James Brady. I'm the head teller manufacturer's trust company, Sunnyside office. Mr. Sands and I were ordered to open up the safe, which I have part of the dual control. The bandit warned us that nobody had anything to lose but the insurance company. Inside the vault, I was ordered to give him nothing but the green stuff, which amounts to $63,933.29.
Once again, a polite little man with a gun left the Sutton trademark. So once again, police dug into official files for a photograph of Willie the actor. And once again, Slick Willie was identified. Based on the facts you've heard tonight and or other pertinent material,
the grand jury of the county of Queens, by this indictment, accused William Sutton of the crime of robbery in the first degree, committed as follows. The defendant in the county of Queens, on or about March 9th, 1950, unlawfully took certain property, to wit, United States currency owned by the Manufacturers Trust Company.
It is not our function here to determine the guilt or innocence of a man, nor do we intend to. But by this indictment, this formal charge by society, William Sutton is wanted.
Here again is Alan Hind.
You can put the finger on Willie Sutton. All right, what are the facts about this character? What does he look like? How does he dress? What are his habits? These we will give you, but first, where does a hot can of corn like Sutton hide out?
My name is John Quigley. I'm employed in the Farm Colony Hospital, Staten Island, New York, as a plumber. In picking up a paper a couple of weeks ago, I discovered a photograph of a chap that was an old bedmate of mine at the name of Edward Lynch. Edward Lynch worked in the Farm Colony for 2.5 years, and a very fine, upright chap he was, a person to go out of the way at any time to lend a hand. And imagine to my great surprise to discover this photograph to be a photograph of one Willie Sutton, a bank robber.
John Quigley lived with the man alleged to be Willie Sutton for 2.5 years, and he never got wise. This could happen to anybody. It could happen to you. Willie the actor might be your next-door neighbor. You might be his next victim. How can you recognize him? Listen to your local announcer.
On page 16 of today's New York Daily Mirror, you will find a picture of William Sutton. Page 16 of today's New York Daily Mirror. If you know of or have any information which can lead the police to the hideout of William Sutton, do these three things. First, be sure of your facts. Don't accuse an innocent man. Second, dial operator and say, I want the police. Third, give your name and address clearly. Remember, page 16, today's New York Daily Mirror. And now back to Alan Hine.
If you should spot Sutton, don't go near him. He is branded by the FBI as highly dangerous, probably ready to shoot to kill. Now study Sutton's picture. Remember that face.
Sutton is 48 years old, height 5 feet 8 inches. He's a mild-looking, mild-mannered man. Hair dark brown, possibly gray. Eyes blue, complexion medium. The end of his little finger is scarred and deformed. Sutton may be wearing any number of disguises.
What kind of a man is William Sutton? Listen to a voice from the underworld.
Willie Sutton, he's some actor. This guy is crazy about his brown wavy hair. And he's a very neat dresser. This guy can walk into a joint, lay $125 on the line for a suit, then rig a flower in his lapel, and on top of it, wear dark-tinted horn-rimmed glasses. And boy, can this guy eat. He can walk into a ballpark, lay 5 to 10 frankfurters away in one shot. But this guy is hot. He can't be seen at ballparks, and he's nuts about the Dodgers. So you'll probably find him at television bars where he thinks nobody can know him. And let me tell you another thing about this guy who's pushing 48. He's got some twist. He's crazy about young, stupid, pretty broads. The younger they are, the better he likes them.
Those are the complete facts on William Sutton. Police know the Sutton pattern, and they've studied their man. They suspect him of several other jobs, including the $1,500,000 Brinks robbery in Boston. But to this date, they have absolutely no leads as to his present whereabouts. Ladies and gentlemen, Willie Sutton must be brought to justice. Sutton has become, in these past 20 years, a legend, a dangerous legend. Willie the actor, clever, smart, too smart for the cops, too smart for any mere honest citizen. Willie the actor is slick, slick Willie. That's the legend. Well, let's examine the facts. Just how slick is Slick Willie Sutton? He's spent almost 20 of the last 27 years in prison. With all his bank robbing, he's averaged less than $75 a week. He's lived like a hunted rat in constant danger of being shot down or stabbed in the back. That's slick? Not in my book. But Sutton is dangerous, so keep on the lookout. You, Mr. Average Citizen, you're a lot slicker, and you can put Sutton back where he belongs. Now, this is Alan Hine saying there is no time like now to wipe out crime.
Be with us next week when you will hear the eyewitness accounts of Edward Sadowski. Wanted. Wanted for murder.
All material heard on tonight's program was factual, from the record. The voices of the late Captain McVeigh and the late Joseph Rosenthal were impersonated. Alan Hine's latest study in crime can be read in this month's issue of True, the magazine for men. Tonight's report was written by P.L. Mayer. Music was by Morris Pomorski. The narrator was Fred Collins. Wanted was directed by Walter McGraw, supervised for NBC by James Kovac, and produced by McGraw Associates. This is for audition purposes only.